lost all my bills.
Going to open the House Committee on Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities. It's April 16th, 2009. I'm going to carry over a work session on House Bill 2999. That is our PURS. We've got, I think, one more clarifying amendment, and then the fiscal back. We may be able to have it back by this evening. We're working on that. I'm going to carry over the work session to this evening. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2119. And I need witness sheets.
No. 2219.
Hearing.
Or did you give it a wrong number?
I'm going to check that number there, Mr. Chairman.
Sorry, 2219. Sorry, it is.
2219.
It's okay.
Mr. Dorchins.
That's what I'm here for.
We could open them on just a bunch of bills randomly.
Yeah,
well, not in our committee.
Yeah.
That other bill is leave it in whatever. We'll leave that one open.
Senate Bill 80, cap and trade. Representative Shoffler, do you want
to
open
it? Let's just kill it right now, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. So I think I've correctly opened a public hearing on House Bill 2119.
Yeah. 2219.
I looked at the thing again. I'm sorry. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2219. Okay. Bob Weber, Ron Anglin, and Barry Beshu. Or Kurt and Ron, are you both coming? Okay, so Bob Weber, Ron Anglin, and Kurt Melcher.
Bob Weber talks on Tuesday.
He did, and Barry talked on Tuesday, and he's not here. So, Jim Welsh. That's what the check marks that say already talked on Tuesday mean.
Huh. Darn.
Yeah. That reading is an issue for me sometimes, apparently.
Sorry. Take some responsibility for that.
Thank you. This is Glenn Coates. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Klem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director for Department of Fish and Wildlife. And we have handed out copies of our written testimony for House Bill 2219. It is dated April 14th. We chose to not revise that, so you can do that by hand if need be. House Bill 2219 is the department's bill regarding the Landowner Preference Program. The Landowner Preference Program was first authorized by the legislature in 1981, and the original intent of this legislation was to allow landowners who were unsuccessful in controlled hunt draws the ability to hunt deer and elk on their own property. The legislature has adopted changes to the LOP program approximately five times since its initial adoption, and the last significant changes occurred in 1995. Currently, we have approximately 6,300 landowners registered and participating in the program. This legislation, the current program legislation, will sunset at the end of this year, and so the department formed a review committee to review the program. The committee included members of both the hunting community and the landowner communities, as well as our producers, agricultural producers. And the committee brought forward revisions to the program, and the revisions that the committee came up with relative to legislation are included in House Bill 2219.
Minus one.
Thank you, Chair Klem, members of the committee. The committee also made a recommendation for the commission to change some administrative rules relative to the minimum size of acreage. The minimum acreage size is not part of the bill or the original legislation. So, true, there was another recommendation that was not adopted by the commission. However, the recommendations for changes to the statute are all included here.
And I don't mean to interrupt your testimony, but we had Bob Weber in here opposing the bill because the recommendations weren't adopted or brought as a whole. And I just wanted to make clear that that's where the issue lies, is that this is the enhancement part of it in terms of transferability of tags, male antelope carve-out for the landowners, and the part that the hunters were interested in was the raising the minimum acreage, which would take tags out of the landowner pool. And that became the work group on a minority vote, or no, majority vote with a minority dissent. The work group recommendation was to do all those things, and then the staff recommendation to do all those things, and then the commission did not accept that package.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, that's correct. In administrative rule, the current minimum for instance, for buck deer in the controlled hunt units is 160 acres in eastern Oregon. And a majority, as you point out, of the committee did recommend to the commission to increase that to 640 acres. The commission heard public testimony and chose not to do that. That would affect approximately 1,900 of the 6,300 participants in this program. It would essentially take them out of the program. So the commission did not adopt that in administrative rule. So as written, House Bill 2219 would extend the sunset from January 2, 2010 to January 2, 2026. The bill would also, as you mentioned, Representative Clem, the bill would also include tags for buck antelope for landowners that hold more than 5,000 acres or 5,000 acres or more. And it also includes some additional flexibility for transferability of tags. Currently, the current program, includes that landowners can transfer up to one-third of their tags to non-family members. This bill, as currently written, would allow the transfer of 50% of those tags to non-family members. And finally, the bill also includes a six-year pilot program that would allow additional landowner preference tags to landowners who provide either increased public access for hunting on their property, on property that may otherwise be closed to hunting, landowners that allow juvenile or youth hunters between the ages of 12 and 17 access to the property, or landowners that provide hunters and anglers access to their lands in order to access adjacent public lands that would otherwise not be accessible. And with that, close our testimony, and I have Mr. Ron Anglin here as well to answer any questions that the committee may have. Thanks.
Jim?
Chair Clem and committee members, Jim Welsh here representing the Oregon Cattlemen Association. And we were very active. In fact, I think I made all the meetings in the review process. And we had, I think, a very successful review process. We really appreciate the opportunity to take a look at the LOP program, working, of course, with landowners and the hunting community. And we're all hunters, too. So, you know, all these issues are near and dear to us. And we certainly want the sunset extended. This is a very important program to us. And, yes, we had a lot of discussion around the change in acreage size for receiving tags. And it was the cattlemen and Farm Bureau. We all agreed that there were high-value crops represented on smaller acreages. And, you know, just to focus on one, those around the Hood River area, you know, the very nice high-value crops on small, you know, a couple hundred acres, 100 acres, 50 acres, and the deer population in that area can cause some real damage. And so we had to, in every way, protect the smaller acreages, we felt, and we felt they're important, and the commission agreed with us on this. And so that's it was all our effort in lobbying and talking, and they decided that 1,900 smaller acreage representatives, landowners, was important. Dynamics on the ground have changed somewhat, too. And so on the larger areas, you know, we weren't able to get, you know, back in the 80s when this program was developed, we weren't able to get the kind of water that we can to the ground, over on, especially on the east side. And so development of hay and alfalfa important to feeding livestock is changing some dynamics. So we see large population of deer and elk moving in to those areas for forage. And so the landowners are really feeding the game of the state on a very regular basis. And it's really hitting their bottom line. Plus, in a lot of areas, and certainly on the west side. I know the landowners that have to repair damage to fence lines, gates, and things from elk herds, too. And so this just continues, and they want some relief from that. And we understand. We had long discussions again in the review process with the hunters of connecting, their concern of connecting damage to the TAG allocation process. And yes, we agree there is further discussion and work and an improvement that we can make to the LOP program. But we didn't take the time to dwell on that, and we need to in the future. This is, you know, any kind of program, when dynamics start changing on the ground, can be changed and can be improved. And we'd love to work with them on that, because I think we can have a better program. But I have to remind you that it's going to be costly to the department when we do this. And because it's going to require more scientific data and calculations that are going to take more manpower and more time, better programs, so that we, when you make that kind of determination, that kind of connection, it's scientific. They can help. Another thing that we have to remember is the damage. Actions that we can ask for as landowners today can be very destructive to herds, okay? This is something that's in statute, and we as hunters, as landowners, are very concerned about, because it's not scientific. It's a reaction to loss on the ground to the landowner, and they're saying help. And we can lose a lot of animals immediately that way. Those are animals that will migrate back in the hills, will be out there for the hunters during hunting season, important to them. But when the damage comes down and hammers your livelihood, you say help. And the damage hunt is there to take, and then we can lose a lot of animals in that process. And not something we like to talk a lot about or refer to, but remember, that provision is in statute, is in rule for the department to use. We can do a better job in this program. We would like to discuss this in the future, but right now this program, as designed, and we certainly supported the things that we worked on, there's no doubt about it, but we're here to help you make determinations and help the department. We have a great working relationship with them on that, and we look forward to the future.
Questions for this panel? Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we know what percentage of LLPs get taken and what percentage of regular tags get taken? I mean, I think I heard 5,000 or 6,000 farms in the total LLPs. Therefore, I mean, that's a lot of tags in comparison to the tags we actually give out. So I just was wondering if there was a comparison between the percentages.
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, just to clarify the question, so there's 6,300 participants in the Landowner Preference Program, and is the question how many tags do we distribute to those 6,300?
No, what's the harvest percentage in those?
Okay. Ron Anglin may have that answer off the top of his head, but I'll defer to him if it pleases the committee.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. I don't have the exact percentage off the top of my head on their success rate, but it does tend to be considerably higher on private land than what it is on public land when it comes to harvesting animals. On public land, typically will be somewhere in the 20-35% range on success rate, and on the LOP tags, we typically see somewhere in the 70-80% range.
Yeah, Representative Krieger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the work that the work group did, but I wish they could have come to a consensus on a couple places that would have made it ever easier for us and break the division down. The chair and I talked about it a little bit. You heard already some conversations about what landowners do, and I think there's a lot of difference in the last 6-7 years. I, for instance, on my own property, have put in food plots that are fenced livestock out. It's only for wildlife. They're special mixes of food sources. 2 weeks ago, I spent probably $100-some fertilizing that, because whether we take them or not, I still want that, you know, to be there. I have irrigated ground that the cattle do get on that I pull off in early August and then start irrigating that, refertilize it, so they've got it all of August, September, October, November before the big winter starts, because I think it's a benefit to the resource that they have at that time of year when a lot of the green foliage isn't available. And you mentioned about getting people to come on property and providing hunting opportunity. About 3-4 weeks ago, I got a handwritten letter from a Drew farmer, fifth grader in Brookings, and I knew her father. And she was talking to me about the problem about school funding, what was happening in our schools. But when we were done with the conversation, I called her on the phone and talked to her. She asked if she could come up and hunt turkeys on my tree farm. What did you think I said? You know, I'm not going to turn a fifth grade little girl down who, you know, fifth generation Curry County person, so I don't know if she's killed one up there or not, but we do, I think, provide a lot of opportunity, not only to hunt for other people, but that when we don't hunt them, that's kind of a sanctuary where those animals can grow and be protected, and then they do move out onto adjacent properties. That's all.
More questions. So let me ask this before we get the other two up. If we, I mean, we don't have a lot of time left, but if we gave a little more time, is there any chance that we would make some progress? It's for you, Jim. Remember, we talked earlier that we might have this all worked out before it ever came here. That hasn't happened. Could we, you know, if we've got a little more time, a week?
Well, it may be very fair to just go one more round and see and not take up excess amount of your time. We provided a negotiation proposition on Tuesday, and we haven't heard whether or not the hunters would choose to come on board on that or not. So we just need to probably determine that through a meeting and one round of this and come back to you.
Well, we've got some more folks to testify, but we'll see, but I appreciate that. I mean, you know, if I were putting my offerings in, or if I do join in the mix, some of the things that you know, I listened to like 8 hours or something worth of these hearings myself on DVD or something, so I could hear some of the issues. If I understand right, landowner preference tags can only be used on your own property. And what's the penalty for getting caught being off your property using a landowner preference tag?
Chair Clem, Representative Krieger probably would know that off the top of his head, as well as state police in the back, but it'd be hunting in an area without a valid tag.
That's right.
And I don't know what the fee schedule is off the top of my head.
Do we do anything to remove people from the LOP program if they're abusing it?
Chair Clem, in previous rulemaking, no, we did not. But in what was adopted this go-around, the committee did recommend setting up a process to do exactly that, and we do have that in place now.
So what's the penalty?
Depending on whether it's first time, severity of the abuse, things like that, they can be suspended from the program anywhere from 1 to 2 years. And if there's multiple offenses, I believe the numbers of years of suspension is bigger.
So I'll just make one comment and go up some room. I mean, I think there's some room for me. One strike and you're out. Now, that's worth a bunch more transferability. That's the deal. You know, that's the kind of stuff we should be talking about. You know, well, anyway, we're going to talk about cheating and wildlife later, I think, in a different bill. So, Representative Roblin.
Yeah, I just want to, you know, putting antelope in was interesting to me when I saw it. And I guess what I would say is it sounds as if the work we're doing is paying off in antelope, that we have better herds, and I am pleased to see that. I just hope we aren't starting this before we really know we've got this good sustainable herds that are going, and start taking more. And I guess I just hear, are you comfortable with this actually puts a bunch more antelope out there to be hunted out of the total number.
Chair Klim, Representative Roblin, actually, it would not put additional antelope out there to be hunted. What we would do is, once you establish a record of how many LOP tags are being issued, what the harvest rate is, those animals come off the top.
Okay.
It does reduce the number of tags available as part of the public draw.
Representative, I can ask him later. Thanks.
Krieger.
Just real quick, you made a comment about if someone gets off their property. If you get into those smaller ownerships and you hit elk with a bow or you hit them with a rifle adjacent to that line, I have seen them go off the property that they were actually shot on, actually being taken in possession of that animal on the adjacent property. Now, is that going to be a violation, and how would you prove different if it's right adjacent? Very, very difficult. You know, if I was going to beat it, if you shot it off there, you go up there and drop a shell on your side of the fence. That's where I was standing. I mean, you got to have some understand what's enforceable, and is this such a problem that it's raised to that high that we need to plug that hole? I don't think we can say that it is.
There was some. Actually, that's an excellent question. I like your response. But there was some testimony about a particular, I don't know if it was a unit or a situation where there was like up to 30% were off their property. In a given deal that I remember hearing on the DVD. I just don't remember the specifics. But I don't want to interrupt Representative Krieger's question, so please.
Chair Klim, Representative Krieger, it's difficult to get an exact number of who may or may not be following the exact rules. I know we do have state police in the room, and they have reported to us multiple times where they're checking hunters in the field, they have LOP tags, and they're anywhere from 60 to 70 miles away from the property that they have valid tags for. And, you know, in OSP's mind, those folks have been out hunting, but they have not been able to catch them in the field hunting.
Chair Klim, we have no patience with those who do not choose to, whether it be a landowner or they be a hunter, you know, abide by our rules. And it is an enforcement nightmare out there, especially when someone chooses to take their tag and go somewhere else. And we had a lot of discussion about that, trying to come up with some sort of resolution on this to help our law enforcement agencies.
Yeah, and I know I was out in just outside of Unity this year, and you know, we're 10 days in, still no buck. There he is. He's 7 yards inside some farmer's property in the fence. Got to pass that up. You can't do it. So we didn't. Got nothing. Skunked. But that's the way it is. And I'm sure we could. I'm sure Representative Krieger's seen somebody who'd drag it over back inside the fence not long thereafter. And so it's not. Didn't mean to impugn just landowners. Everybody wants meat, but you got to play by the rules. So I think I'm good. I mean, I'll share with you privately because you don't want to hear this publicly. My dad's idea. So we'll talk about it later.
Well, the committee's interested, Mr. Chair.
He's shared with some of the committee.
Yeah. Some get special conversations. He's taking care of my dog all week. He gets his ideas shared at least somewhere, sometime. That's a commitment. All right. Mike Dykesel and Joe Rollator. Rollator. I'm going to get it while he's Rollator.
No.
Mike here?
I don't see Mike, Mr. Chair.
Another OFICers or? We'll take you, Joe.
Mr. Chair, members of committee, my name is Joe Rollator. I live in Walport, Oregon. I'm here today representing the Oregon Guides and Packers. We participated in the Landowner Preference Study Group, and our president, Steve Mathers, was our representative. He's unfortunately, guides start working this time of the year and they can't come in and testify for themselves, so I asked him to write up a little something about what his thoughts were. And as you can see from his thoughts, the biggest issue for guides and packers is transferability. We participated in a group, came to a compromise decision, and we're willing to live with that decision. If you want to go back into a work group, we'd be very happy to do that. Transferability for me as a property owner, as you know, I've got a real small piece of land that I live on the coast. It's actually only 12 acres. I have 15 or 25 elk there a lot because I have the only good pasture around. I think that's the case of many of my neighbors. My neighbors that have big enough properties to participate in landowner preference use the landowner preference as a way to transfer tags that then would be used by people who paid for the access to hunt on their property. And in lieu of the green forage and the other wildlife damage programs that we used to get paid for fertilizer, we used to get grass seed, they used to help us with our fences. Most of that is completely gone. This is a program, and that's why the program is used that way. And it's a very important program to Oregon Guides and Packers, and I think it's probably a very, very important program to landowners that are in the system. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And, you know, it's an important program for hunters, too.
Yes,
certainly
really
the animals they wouldn't be there if it weren't for private landowners. There's no doubt about that. And it's not my intention or I think anyone's to have this program go away. It's about,
excellent,
while we're renewing the sunset, what improvements can be made to the program. Now, I've spoken with you about something, and I forgot to ask Jim about it. I asked Barry about it briefly. Your thoughts on if we, you know, I think we're going to take another run at trying to get this resolved before the session, before this committee can't work on this bill anymore. Your thoughts on limiting the transferability to Oregon residents only?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's fine with me. That's fine with our membership. I think that's another equitable compromise. I used to work for ODFW, and I had opportunity to testify on this bill on behalf of the department before. And so I learned quite a little bit about it, even though I'm basically a fish guy. You've got so many tags. You have a biological cake that's set up before you set out the quota and allocate the quota between user groups. So that's not going to change. That's based on science. So if you have tags that are allocated to one group, you take them away from another group. Well, there's already a program that allocates non-resident tags. So I think that it's a reasonable compromise to make these resident tags.
Actually, you don't sell.
Representative Krieger.
You do have in farm, ranch, forest communities where you have one ownership, or where there might be a family like two brothers. One lives in Oregon, one lives in Washington, California, but they combine. They own the land, but he's not a resident of the state that he owns the land in. And you wouldn't want to penalize the owner of the land to come back. You might say that to non-family members. I can see that.
Chair Clem, Representative Krieger, as I understood the proposal from Representative Clem, the residency requirement would only apply to the transferability. So in other words, if my partner were from out of state, they could come in and hunt on their own land. They're a property owner, even though they're from out of state. But if you transferred for access to the a landowner preference tag or a portion of your landowner preference tags, those could only be transferred to residents. Is that correct, sir?
I think so.
Yeah. Okay. So I think that's a proposal.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking is, would you, is there enough in terms of where the tags get transferred? I don't even know where, but would there be a problem with limiting it to Oregon residents? Is there enough? It's not business isn't the right word because I think you charge access fees, not sell tags. I don't think that's legal. But the access fees that you charge, is there enough Oregonians who would like to pay an access fee to warrant not having out-of-state involvement, unless maybe it was a family member, something you could add in there. But that's a thought. That's a work group conversation. I think I'll let us off the hook now because I'm not on the work group yet. So anybody, I think the folks know who they are who probably need to work this out, if possible. If not, we'll have some amendments about renewing the sunset. Thanks, Joe. I want to acknowledge written testimony from Mike Dykesel, Sharon Livingston, Bill Wilbur. That's it. with that, I will close a public hearing on House Bill 2219. So do I need to open a work session and then carry it over?
No, you can.
I'm not in a work session, so I don't think it's so I'm carrying over a work session on 2219 to allow time for an informal work group. Carry over to our next regular meeting, Tuesday, April 21st at 8 a.m. We can open a work session on House Bill 2220. We're in a situation where we're reading back from the Speaker's office on whether to rescind the subsequent referral. This is the authorize the persons transporting recreational commercial watercraft to stop at a check station. And bill sponsor, would you like to wait a little longer on the ways
and means? It's fine. Yeah, I mean, we took out all the cost plus bill. We aren't doing any of the stuff. All we're doing is putting in the statute to allow us to stop them. And in the venture, when we have some money, we can build the station. So it has no cost. I mean, I don't understand this. I have no problem waiting.
I think it's just
we're getting good
formality
at that.
Way. It's in the line. Okay, so I am going to, we'll go ahead and wait then. So I'll carry this work session over, close the work session on House Bill 2220, carry it over to tonight.
If the chair changes.
Maybe. I'll carry it over until tonight, and if we don't get it, we'll carry it over again. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2153. Yes, and Director, the DSL is going to come up. We had some conversation. It's been a while ago, but we had some conversation around this issue and wanted to get any questions answered and then see if we've got the support for the bill or not. I have no preconceived outcomes not having talked to you or heard about this in a month and a half, but I just want to get into it. And I'm going to have to step outside for just one moment on a situation. So if you can help navigate the conversation.
All right. Thank you. Go ahead.
Excuse me. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Louise Soliday, Director of the Department of State Lands. I think I've visited with most of you or your staffs in the last couple of weeks just to remind you about this bill and see where you were on it. Just a reminder, this is a bill that would give us civil penalty authority for trespasses that occur on state-owned uplands. We have similar authority for our waterways. Currently, the only tool we have available to use is a criminal trespass charge for folks who are trespassing on our uplands. And while that may be an appropriate penalty for somebody who is willfully dumping hazardous waste on land that they know is state-owned, it's probably not appropriate for a wheat farmer who's out there who's farming our land not knowing that it's state land. And so we think having a range of civil penalties available to us will help us to work with landowners, get them in compliance, make sure that they have proper authorizations from the Department of State Lands for the use of our lands. We lease those lands. We're in the business of leasing our lands, trying to generate revenue for the Common School Fund. We want to make sure that everybody is playing by the same rules, and having the civil penalty authority, we believe, will give us a little bit softer instrument in terms of dealing with some of those folks. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. And I appreciate the department coming and clarifying this bill to me. I just want to make it very clear. If you got some idiot out there dumping a bunch of crap on state lands, I want him to be tried as a criminal. If we change this, I would like to see it allow that the innocent weed farmer who may have been farming on that land for generations is pursued through any action through a civil action, because they're not a criminal. So a clear distinction there, and that's what's brought me around to support this bill, because the farmer's not a criminal, the idiot is a criminal. See, follow me?
Mr. Chair and Representative Shoffler, I follow you.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions? Yes, Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess maybe to follow up on Representative Shoffler, the idea is that if you do find that poor wheat grower that's on your land and you can work with them to try to get them to stop, there are different levels of civil penalties, so that if year after year they're not stopping, they do start looking like a criminal to me. but.
Madam Chair and Representative Beyer, we agree. And one of the factors that we use in our civil penalty formulas is repeat offenders. So they know they're continuing the activity, then the fine level would escalate. And that's the reason why the bill directs us to do rulemaking, consider these criteria, and have a schedule that fits the penal, the activity that's going on out there.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess mine goes to the question now that got brought up by Representative Beyer, and that is there are in the minds of in some of these people, and the issue we talked about the other day with respect to submersible lands, where they truly believe they own the land. And you may send them a deal saying that they don't, but they've got a deed from the county, not a deed from the state, but a deed from the county that says they own that land. And so they get into this argument with you, and the state saying, no, our deeds don't show that we sold that land to you over the period of time. That's the person I wish we could get to some kind of agreement without fining anybody. And I agree they're going to continue to farm that land because they really believe it's theirs. I mean, it's going to be hard for them to not believe it's theirs. I would encourage them to go find an attorney and get it worked out. But the reality is they don't think there's a dispute because they have a deed that says they own it. And you know there's no dispute because you have a deed that says they haven't got it. So that is a dispute, and I would hope that that wasn't one that leads to the criminal fines, that we kind of figure out a way to get to a solution.
Madam Chair and Representative Roblin, I agree with that. And that's a situation that doesn't happen very often with uplands. It's much more a waterway Correct. Issue. But I will talk about an example on our uplands where we discovered a person holding a deed to a property that the BLM had transferred to us and then transferred to this individual afterwards. So they BLM has transferred the same property twice, once to the state and once to someone else. So what we've done in that case is we've gone to the BLM and said, look, we've discovered this. They've now checked their records and agree that that's what happened. And what we've suggested is just let the state select some other lands in lieu of those. We don't want to create a problem for that person who's held the deed. We're not out there to go after people's heads. What we do want to do is make sure that everybody's playing by the same rules, and if we're expecting somebody who's growing crops on our land to share the profits with the Common School Fund, the wheat farmer needs to be doing the same thing. And that so there's this, you have to consider each situation individually and make sure that the penalty fits what the situation is. And I might just also add, we oftentimes want, if we have somebody who cooperates with us, we waive the civil penalty at the end of the day. What we're after is getting people in compliance.
Representative Krieger.
Louise, you said it was administrative rules would set the penalties around this. What would you just, I mean, you can't say it's going to be this or that, but what would be the range that you would be thinking of?
Madam Chair and Representative Krieger, we normally start at a minimum of about $30 a day or $50 a day. So we start very small. This, you know, authorizes up to $1,000 a day. I'm not aware that we've ever done that in our history, with the exception of the new Carissa incident. So we start at a fairly small amount of money. But as I said, we use a formula based on whether somebody's a repeat offender, based on the type of activity that's going on out there.
Representative, did you have a follow-up?
I have a follow-up. Then you're telling me that if it was a pretty severe case, like dumping of hazardous drug material, and the district attorney was going to prosecute, then you would not seek the civil side.
Madam Chair and Representative Krieger, generally that would be the case. If it's that severe, we would use the criminal activity, the criminal enforcement, as opposed to the civil enforcement.
And follow up.
Sure.
And in some circumstances, the court could award cleanup costs or require the offender to, in some other way, compensate the state for any costs that you might have incurred of cleaning it up.
Madam Chair and Representative Krieger, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. My main concern here is not those criminals. You know, they're not. Just go get them. I don't care what you do to them, to be quite frank with you. I just want to clarify my own position here, too, after the conversation here.
Sorry.
My good friends. I like the number one priority, I think, of government is getting people to comply with the law, not arrest them, not fine them, not punish them, many times there, completely, totally, and absolutely innocent, yet they're doing something that's not in compliance. And I don't think that is a, deserves a civil penalty or a criminal penalty. If there is a dispute on who owns the land, and if on the, and there's probably God knows how many scenarios we could dream up here and talk about, but the one that was referenced and you answered to, if the BLM transferred ownership to the state and to the landowner, I tell you, then the hook is on the BLM, not the landowner. I hope that's what you're doing.
Madam Chair and Representative Shuffler, that's exactly what we're doing. We're trying to work this out with the BLM so that that landowner retains that land.
Okay.
We'll be allowed, we're hoping the BLM will say, go select another 40 acres somewhere else.
Yes. No, I'm not. I mean, they should remain whole, and if anybody gets penalized or has to pay or go find another piece of land, it's the BLM that has to go find the other piece of land.
Madam Chair and Representative Shuffler, what the BLM does is allow us to select from their land ownership so that we're made whole,
okay,
and that landowner retains the land.
Thank you very much.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This probably is, in many ways, a... the issues we're talking about right now, rulemaking issue, as Representative Krieger said. But I don't you think we ought to have some reference to disputed land or definition of disputed land so that those folks are protected from the get-go here? I believe you, but what happens when you're not there, you know, and we're doing this now? I'm just concerned that maybe you can show me. There's no reference to disputed land issues.
Madam Chair and Representative Gilliam, when we have an ownership dispute, which is, as I indicated to Representative Rowland, does come up in the waterway issue in particular, we do try and work with those landowners to get those issues resolved, either through you can file a quiet title suit to get into court and get the court to resolve the issue. We try and avoid that. We actually try and go back and do a chain of title search all the way back to statehood to see if we can figure out exactly what occurred when. And so we do try and work with those landowners individually to try and get those ownership disputes resolved. And sometimes it's not clear. I think most of the times it is clear. Once you look at the chain of title, you can figure out what did happen. And I think, you know, and the waterways are complicated because waterways move. They're very dynamic. And so you do get into those situations. Again, we already have this authority on our waterways. We send out a series of four letters to individuals before we ever get to a civil penalty. It takes about 6 months of correspondence. And we start with, we think you've got a structure on state-owned waterway. Let us know if you're not the current owner and we should be talking to somebody else. We don't hear from them. We send them a second letter. Each one gets a little stronger, and the fourth one is we're going to send this over to DOJ to prosecute for trespass. And normally by the time we get to the fourth letter, people are in the door and resolving things. So we do try and work with those folks and get those resolved. It's not, you know, it's not always possible, and sometimes you end up in court with a quiet title suit to get the issue ultimately resolved.
Quick follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I just think I would feel more comfortable if we had some language that said something to the effect, and I'm no lawyer, as you well aware.
Nor am I.
You know, in disputed land that the department believes there is a bona fide title dispute, then such and such, so that that's established here. Not that people would just miss, you can just say, I dispute that's my land, but that you suspect that there's some reasonable standard that they've been issued a duplicate title or they have a family history or whatever it is. That just would make me more comfortable. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
Well, to follow up on Representative Gilliam, I'm presuming that you have policies and procedures that guide you in making the kinds of decisions that he's talking about.
Madam Chair, we have a whole set of rules that govern our management of our uplands, as well as a separate set of rules managing our waterways. So we do have a very extensive set of rules that guide all of the activities that we engage in with landowners involving common school fund real estate.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? If not, Representative Krieger.
It says Mr. Chair. It doesn't look right.
Flexible.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2153 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2153 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any further discussion? Representative Wingard.
Madam Chair, I guess I didn't fully realize we would be moving this bill today. I'm still concerned about the idea of some of the situations that were described and people having civil penalties assessed. And I take Louise at her word about how the department would implement that, but I would feel much more comfortable with language in statute that gave more direction on that. I think that Louise may not always be in the position that she's in, and we are in the process of giving some very broad authority. And I've listened in another committee at some length to some of the situations that exist out there, and I'm just not comfortable with the bill at this point. I have no one visited me ahead of time to walk me through it, and I realize we just had a hearing on it, but I'm not prepared to support the bill at this point in time. It's possible I could get there, but I think the bill will probably move without me, but I feel the need to put that on the record.
Okay, thank you. Representative Krieger.
Just before Louise stepped down, she made the comment about cases going to the Supreme Court or cases being appealed might take some time.
If you are.
I don't know how many of these they might have over a period of time, but when they're taken through the district attorney, and that then the department probably doesn't have a lot of investment. If you start through a civil process and you had very many of these, you could end up with a lot of time involved with staff, but yet we got a fiscal that says no impact. And that cannot be. And we see that routinely in this building. When a department wants something, somehow it comes out that they can absorb it.
Maybe it's not.
If they don't want it, I've seen fit. We got one we talked about in Coastal Caucus today. $400,000. In fact, we're going to challenge it. So those types of things, I think we need to always be watching in every committee we're in, because I have no confidence in the fiscals that are coming back anymore. They should be something that guide us, that we have confidence in, that we're making the right policy choice. And that is not happening in this building this year.
Yes, Representative Roblin.
Two comments. One, that most of the issues we talked about in the other committee are already taken care of. The civil penalties already exist on waterways. But I agree, I don't think there's as many upland ones. And I feel more comfortable with this bill with regard to having those opportunities so that they don't move to the heavy hammer every time instead of, when you have to go to use the gun when you should have been just talking to people, it's not the best way to get things to work. So I'm more comfortable there. The only thing that I wondered is if we do, and I guess there was no request for a revenue impact, or the revenue impact came back?
Yeah.
No revenue impact?
Minimal. Minimal or none.
Which means that they're not going to charge anybody, so there won't be any fines. So I feel more comfortable with that. Because they wouldn't, if it was a big one, it would mean that they were planning to go out there and fine a lot of people, but since there is no revenue impact, I'm feeling more comfortable.
This is not binding.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly to reiterate, the department, I think, has made a great case. I have no problem with them. I'm not suspicious of some other motive. I appreciate them coming to my office. However, to Representative Wingard's point, because things change, I'm uncomfortable and can't vote for it at this point. Property rights, I think, are a touchy subject, especially for me, and I'm just not comfortable with this one.
Well, I do have a note that says that practical effect of a claim of ownership is a defense to any penalty. So if that helps. Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. I support the bill after it's been explained to me. I want to just chime in and agree with my friend from Gold Beach, Representative Krieger. It is kind of like magic, some of these fiscal and revenue determinations, and I know this is better suited for the remonstrances on the floor, but I mean, I've seen very clear fiscal impact statements that, unless you have a crystal ball, they should have been said indeterminate. Yet they come up with these incredible estimates where on the very same bills that have been through fiscal office over the years where there was no impact. And I share his frustration. That being said, I see the logic behind this. I don't want to make criminals out of wheat farmers. I want to bust idiot criminals who are crapping all over this world. So I will be supporting the bill.
Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do support the bill, but I think maybe I might have a question to the department, if that's possible.
Would you come back, please?
Thanks. Yes, Louise. I'm assuming that we have staff dealing with these issues now. We just don't have a way to handle them besides the criminal penalties.
Madam Chair and Representative Beyer, that's correct. And just on the fiscal issue, so we have staff who are working in this arena every day, and so we were not expecting that we don't need any additional staff in order to implement this, and that's why the no fiscal on the revenue side. We don't know what the revenue is likely to be. We don't know how many of these civil penalties we would actually levy. As I indicated, it's not something we want to go out and do willy-nilly. And so it's a number we don't know. We just don't know what it's going to look like.
Thank you. And as just a little follow-up on that is that this is really a tool that we're giving them. We're not increasing their workload because they're already doing this work now. We're just giving them a tool to do a better job at it. So I certainly support the bill.
Representative Roblin.
Just to respond to Representative Krieger and to Representative Schaffler. So this will be my remonstrance because I don't want to do it on the floor either. And is that I think that the difference a lot of times with these fiscals is the willingness and the amount of work that the sponsors of the bill go down in there and sit with them and go talk to the agencies and talk to them about, you know, are you going to do this internally or are you not? Because I think oftentimes the general reaction is if we tell somebody to do something, they say it's going to take somebody else. But if you get in there and say, look, show me how this is going to take somebody else, and you can get them to take that off, then for the Poor Revenue Office, when they get the stuff from the departments that they ask for, doesn't have 10 more people in it. It just has, no, they can do it on their own, which is what happened here. You have an agency that would like to have this. They have people already doing this, and so they send, when asked, what's this going to cost you, they say it's no more people. We've got the people already who are doing it. We get in situations at times where we are crafting a bill and other people are at odds with it, and so the agencies out there will say this costs X amount, and you've got to go deal with them on each an individual case-by-case cases, and I think some of our representatives don't realize that at times, and so you end up with these really high costs because they didn't keep talking to people about what we're really expecting, and I agree with you, and I appreciate the questions you asked, so thank you.
Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Gilliard.
No.
Representative Roman.
Aye.
Representative
Shoffman? Aye.
Representative Wigman?
No.
Vice Chair Bettelman?
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Chair Krieger?
Excused. The motion passes, and the bill is sent to the floor.
We should carry it.
Clem would be rid of it. Clem would be rid of it.
That's funny. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
I guess Chair Clem is the carrier.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, we will open the public hearing on 2636.
Which one is that?
Representative Krieger.
Okay, I've got so many bills. Yes, it does.
Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, Wayne Krieger, State Rep, District 1. And the director, state director of the Wildlife Services that takes, has the government, call them predation control people, was supposed to be here today, Mr. Williams. He's not. However, this issue came up as a result of my conversation of one of my sheriffs in Coos County that had just retired, where a government employee of the Department of Agriculture, the predation side, is not falling under the definitions to be able to discharge a firearm inside the city limits. So oftentimes in rural communities, other places where they do not have a police officer or sheriff available, he may have a cougar up a tree inside the city or a rabid this or a rabid that, and he does not have the authority to dispatch that animal. So it just gives them authority to discharge a firearm in the line of their duties for that purpose and not be in violation of the law.
Are there any questions of Representative Krieger?
Madam, there is one change that's coming. The state police asset in that bill where the word agent is employed, that this needs to be an employee of the United States Department of Agriculture. And then down below right there, like on line 19, where it says agency would not need to be there either. So the amendment takes that out. The rest of the bill remains the same.
Madam Chair, I do have a question.
Yes, Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Representative. Has it ever happened that an agent of the U.S. government has been taken to court over the lawful taking of wildlife?
I don't believe so, but I'm not aware that what they've had to do is, if they are inside the city limits, they, by their own policy of the department, know they don't have that authority. So they get on the radio, and they call, either the city police or the sheriff, and say, hey, we got a problem here. We need an officer who can come and dispatch this animal.
Right.
You know, so it causes time, and also it puts it out over the air that poor animal, you know, and then PETA, people eating tasty animals get upset, and here they come.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, Representative.
This is just another example of you trying to put common sense into the statute, and I appreciate your efforts.
Thank you.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, thank you for bringing this forward, and I'm supportive of the bill, and I hesitate to ask questions about it, knowing that you already have the authority that this bill would create for other agents. But I just am curious, when you introduced yourself as number one, is that your district or is that some other designation that you've given yourself?
I was originally 48. Because of my performance, I was rated number one.
Thank you for clarifying that.
So, represent.
Representative.
Thank you very much. So this is only clarifying for United States Department of Agriculture, because our people already have that authority.
That's right.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure. Mm-hmm. But I'm good. It's a good bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Byer. Uh-oh, you're not released yet.
See, nobody talks down here, so no one looks at us.
But when you do, we listen, Representative.
That's right. I understand where you're coming from on this bill. I think the only concern that I might have, and it's probably, if other agencies already have this authority, it's probably kind of a mute question, but when you're doing this in an urban area where people would hear firearms going off and call the sheriff's office or the police office to say there's someone shooting out here, and they then don't know who's out there and would have to respond anyway. So do you see any problem with this? I mean, it kind of seems to me like it does. Either way, it's going to cause some work
Mr.
for the
Chair,
department.
And Representative Byer, I'm not saying that this happens very often, but if it is an odd and unusual time and you've got a critter in a certain circumstances up a tree, they don't always stay there. They'll jump out and away they go again. And if it's been one that's been a real problem, killing livestock along a city, and the fact the cougar problem is they're killing dogs and cats in towns, mm-hmm.
that maybe as rare as that's going to be, it probably would be far more beneficial to have him be able to do it, his job, and then simply report on the radio that he's done it, or even call in that he's going to do it so someone knows. And I think that's probably pretty much how they work anyway. They're not going to just go in there and start shooting. They're going to probably notify, hey, I'm here, I got this, and I'm going to take care of it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2636. Going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3068. And going to tweet. I'm going to call Al Elkins and Wayne Elliott and Tom Wolf up.
Which one did he open up on?
3068, Mr. Chair.
3068.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. With me today is Wayne Elliott, a board member of the Oregon Hunters Association, who will testify on the bill. This is our bill. We requested it, and the committee was good enough, your committee, Mr. Chair, was good enough to introduce it for us. And Mr. Elliott will explain what the bill does.
Good morning, Chair Clem and members of the committee. I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Wayne Elliott from John Day. I am the Northeast State Director for the Oregon Hunters Association. And I'd really like to thank you, the committee, for the opportunity to testify on this bill today. I'm here to support the House Bill 3068. OHA feels that the penalties that are imposed on the illegal harvest of the state's game is inadequate, and that we'd like to see greater civil penalties for the illegal taking of the mature breeding class game animals and species with limited numbers and also limited hunting opportunity. And also species that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife are trying to establish within the state. Our feelings that the greater civil penalties would help reduce the illegal taking of these game animals. To help in the reduction, Oregon Hunters Association drafted House Bill 3068. And in the bill, it defines, it gives a definition for the mature breeding class animals. And it would impose higher civil penalties for the illegal taking of these animals. The penalties that we propose are in line with other Western states that have similar legislation. Colorado, Montana, Utah, Arizona, all have similar legislation, and the civil penalties are in balance with the penalties that these states do have. As our numbers differ from the other states, some of the rarities of some of the species and the restrictive hunting opportunity on some of these species, we feel it warrants higher civil penalties on those species. And the proposed civil penalties that we've proposed over the board are higher for antelope, moose, mountain goat, and bull elk. And the deer and mountain sheep proposed penalties are less than the average penalties imposed by these other states. So the numbers are for the mature class on the bill are what OHA is proposing. I'd like to thank you again for the opportunity to testify today, and I'd be glad to answer any questions that the committee may have.
I'll finish. Go ahead and finish the panel. Al, do you want to comment, or you're good? You've got your expert right here. That's great. Tom?
Chair Clem, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, a conservation group composed of fishermen. I'm just going to be very brief. We support this bill. We feel that that there does need to be increased penalties for the ill taking of game. We particularly support We support M and N, which deal with game fish and increased penalties for the illegal taking of that. We feel that there is some problems with there, and we support the Oregon Hunters Association and their efforts to do something about the illegal poaching of game. And that's my comments. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I would like to make one comment. We have been working with the proponents of House Bill 3089, which is up on the schedule next, and it is our intent to collapse our bill into their bill, and we have some amendments that are drafted. We've been working with Mr. Representative Krieger's office, Representative Schaffer's office, and we're supportive of that. We just briefly looked at the draft of the amendments this morning, so we're in line with what the amendments say. The ones that we've seen so far.
Representative Gillian?
Just a quick question. I think you guys could help me. On 23, since you're going to collapse this, you might be able to address this. Should it say silver ore, gray squirrel?
I believe the definition in the from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Ron Anglin may be able to help me in the back, but it's a silver gray squirrel is the species.
It is a silver gray. Yes. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
How do we regulate taking of squirrels now, or the silver gray squirrel specifically?
Already more.
What?
Existing, isn't it?
Yeah, he wants to know.
Yeah, that's
that.
Existing.
It's existing.
That would be a good question.
What does that mean?
This language already exists in the statute.
Yeah, but do we have a? Do you have to have a tag?
No. Chair?
Yes.
There are open and closed areas and seasons on silver gray squirrel. Some places it's open all year long, where we have almonds and other nuts. They protect those areas by wide open season. Other parts of the state, there's a closure, and then it opens up. I think it used to be September, October, sometime like that. It's in the fall.
So it's by area, and you can hunt them if it's season. But how many?
That's a bag limit. That's determined by the department and the commission. They set that.
Okay.
It's open season.
Representative, do you have something else besides schooling young Snowball here about the squirrel?
He has a question.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to help clarify here, too. Mr. Representative and I had a conversation. He was concerned about the penalty on the fisher. And he was wondering if that was a human being who was being a fisher or if that was a particular kind of animal. because he wasn't quite sure what animal that was. So if you could explain, it would be helpful.
Mr. Jarrett, would you tell Mr. Roblin that I can occasionally speak for myself?
No.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy.
No, I won't. I'd be happy to repeat what Representative Gilliam said.
Transplant?
Yeah, I
think we have maybe a legitimate question over here. Two legitimate questions. To be determined.
Well, thank you, Chair Clem. One of the questions I have is because we've had so much testimony about the poaching and the illegal capture. Is it an increase in poaching or is it our lack of ability to actually enforce some of the laws that we already have?
Go ahead.
Chair Clem and Vice Chair, I think it's a combination of both.
Okay.
We do have an illegal harvest problem within the state, and we also have hopefully a not too large of a reduction in enforcement, but our enforcement officers, particularly in the eastern part of the state, have to cover a very large area, and so they're hindered in their enforcement efforts by area that they cover. So I really, to answer your question, it's a combination of both.
Okay, thank you.
Where's that figure?
Along her lines, the lack of ability for enforcement isn't that as much it is, but we are in the process of cutting that department. I think something like 26 game officers or something.
Correct.
I mean, I don't know what the number's going to be, but at any rate, this would be a deterrent. There is one, and hope, think about this a little bit, and that's why we didn't make felonies in the other bill out of some things. And I look at on line 22 regarding elk with at least 6 points. 6 points, 5 points, 2 points. I've seen a 4 point bigger than a 6 point. So really how many points isn't as much of importance to me. But then I get to thinking of the things that I saw. A lot of this, when it does happen, not always, especially if you're talking about big trophy animals, yeah, maybe that is a driver. But some people that are out trying to get some food because times are tough, and you're going to see more of that now. Do we want a 22-year-old guy with four kids, unemployed, to have that type of a civil penalty? Is that justice? We have to weigh justice against protecting a resource. And that, to me, I got a little problem with that particular one. The moose one I don't. I've got a few in northeastern Oregon. They come in out of, I think, Idaho and Washington. But I don't know, when someone's on their back and they do something stupid, would you, as a father, let your kids go hungry, or would you go get a deer? And I might say, when I got to Curry County in 64, it was the culture that people kind of lived off the land. Well, we've slowly weaned them off that, and for the basic hunter out there, that belong to more types of organizations like Oregon Hunters and NRA, and you know, are very concerned about maintaining and having wildlife resources. There's less of that type of group that take part in this. So part of it's education. But I'm really concerned about a young family guy. He's young. He does. And how many of you, when you were young, did something stupid? Smile. Lots of smiles out there. Even Jim smiling. I killed my first deer when I was 11 years old in the Gearhart Theater. Up by Seaside. In June, by the way.
What's the statute of limitations?
Yeah, we have the law enforcement officer right back there to take care of us.
So what I'm saying is, I just want you to comment about the ramifications long term. Is there another way, like taking a hunting license longer, a suspension, that really takes you out of the resource longer, maybe on some of this? Not all, but kind of that one, maybe. I don't know.
Chair Clem and Representative Krieger, in response to a couple of your questions, because I got a couple of them there, with the young father feeding his family and that scenario, in the existing wording, which we are not changing, is that the Fish and Wildlife Commission may institute, and this is already there. Our goal was to target the mature breeding class animals and kind of get away from the word trophy taking, which some of the other Western states have in their language. So,
Mr. Chair, I think what he said is we've established now, kind of through his testimony and what I've said, legislative intent is how we would hope that the department would assess the civil penalties. It's a may, and it would be weighing the circumstance. You know, if I come in there, they're going to hit me $30,000. You know, if they had the right. But I understand. I have to make sure we had it on the record.
Representative Shaw.
Mr. Chair, I have to ask my friend here, you're okay with leaving the way it is, or would you like to, if you say it should be reduced, I think it is rather severe in the scenario he spelled out. Now, you got some scofflaw out there. Well, you know, I could probably even go more severe, but
what is your intention, Representative, just so we get it clear on the
Chair,
amendment?
Yes, please, Representative.
We made a record of the fact that it's very high, that it could adversely affect some young guy with kids, and if there's a circumstance where when the state police, which is normally going to be the one to do those investigations, finds those mitigating circumstances, that we hope they would take those into consideration. I have gone into the court and testified to those things myself, and that did make a difference in what the penalty was. And I would hope that they would do that, because this is a civil penalty that's assessed by the department, then I would hope that they would take that into consideration on the civil side.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, when we were putting this bill together, we worked closely with OSP on a number of meetings, and those are exactly the things that they told us about the variables that occur in the actual courtroom during the actual case. So I believe that your scenario that you just painted would fall into that category.
Thank you.
Okay. So these dash two amendments that we've got in front of us, we don't have a fiscal back, but they would essentially blend 3068 and 3089 together.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. However, I believe there's another set of amendments from Mr. Krieger's office, or excuse me, for Representative Krieger's office or Representative Schaffler's office, that there's only one copy of, and we have the. I believe Mr. Harder is going to talk to those amendments under the other bill.
Okay. Okay. And I will. I will complicate things slightly more. The relating clause in this bill is real nice, and we have our no net loss of hunting bill that would fit in here, along with our acquisition and Representative Witt's acquisition and habitat with no net loss of hunting tied to it that we've talked about. So I've been eyeballing this bill because I like it as it is. You know, once the mergers are complete, we've got that all figured out. But I like Representative Krieger and I chatted about a little idea to finally get the no net loss of hunting done, and I like that too. So maybe after we have disposed of 3068 by moving its contents, it also has a nice relating clause. I won't confuse it more, but I'll come talk to all of you with my trickery before I go much further.
Mr. Chair, they're exactly the same relating clauses.
Yep, isn't that nice?
In there. I mean,
good idea. Let's move forward.
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
Do
we have
Mr. Chair.
Representative Winger for a question for this panel.
Yeah. Yep. Are we also talking about 3089? I mean, are we open on this?
We are not. No, we're not. And we have some different witnesses on that.
You are.
Okay, well, I can wait for my question. So.
Okay. Good. Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bill including in Bob Salinger.
Good morning. My name is Bob Salinger. I'm the Conservation Director for the Audubon Society of Portland. I'm going to save the bulk of my testimony for House Bill 3089, but I just wanted to get up here at this point and very briefly state that we also support House Bill 3068. These are not the species that we typically focus on at Audubon Society of Portland, but we do believe it's important to protect the integrity of our state's wildlife population. So all I want to say this morning was we also support this, and we encourage you to move it forward.
Thank you. Bill.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Committee, mine will be brief. You've heard from the experts. I got on the, well, every year we have these problems, and it's not the sportsmen of this state. It's the outlaws. When I read in the paper about the three trophy bull elk found dead in southern Oregon, I told my sons, I said, you know, there's probably more than three. That time of year, those big bulls are bunched together. Sure enough, the buzzards found two more the following
identify
week.
Identify yourself for the record. I'm sorry.
But, excuse me, for the record, Bill Cooding, speaking on my own behalf.
the two more?
They found more about 4 days later. The buzzards helped find them.
Yeah.
This is what this bill stops. If we can get the judges to go along, President Krieger made a very good point. I want to thank him for his help on this. This isn't for the family man that's hasn't had a job for a year or down on his luck and nowhere to go. These are the people that salvage every bit of meat they can. But when you read where they just cut the heads off or just leave them lay, or maybe take a backstrap, this bill will give the judge the authority. And if this is made public, if these people realize what could happen, and if this continues to go on, these are our we got a lot of tax dollars wrapped up in these trophy animals. And I'll just stop right there. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
For just us.
Yeah. Representative Norman.
Clarification. Bill just pointed out the judge's authority, and I thought we were talking about the department leveling these fines.
Mr. Chair, we're talking about the department as doing the civil side. The
yes.
criminal side is done by the courts.
Right. Okay. So I wanted to be sure that I understood. Thank you.
Representative Roland.
But still, you get a civil penalty and they charge you this. You still have the option to go to court and say, I didn't.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So that you still have a court option.
Yeah.
You
okay.
get the ticket, but you still have to, you know, you can choose to pay it or you can go have your day.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I think we are at the end of our witness list. Going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3068, open a public hearing on House Bill 3089, and got a couple co-sponsors here.
Dress up and check my hair, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Yes.
Please.
I'll let him go down.
Okay.
He's going to do it.
All right.
I haven't had a chance for Schaffler. Career.
Yeah, this is good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mike Schaffler, State Representative, House District 48, Happy Valley, Outer Southeast Portland. It's always an honor to appear before this august committee. And I might add, you're doing fine work. House Bill 3089, I'm far from an expert, but clearly, as Mr. Kludig so clearly pointed out, poaching is bad. I think in those egregious examples like that, not only should they be slapped a huge fine, but they should go to prison for a while and bust big rocks into little rocks. This bill will just be used to needed to protect this valuable resources, which have been pointed out all session here. I might add, if through budgetary problems we lose fish and game officers, which I hope and pray we do not, I think this kind of hammer will be needed even more. Let me see. And as has already been said, there are some pending amendments that need to be put in to make it even better. And, Mr. Chair, I will support whatever measures you see fit to make the statute better relating to hunting and policing poachers. So have at those relating clauses. I look forward to supporting your efforts. With that, I will leave the technical questions to this incredible body of experts that we have in here every day, but I would be happy to attempt to try and answer any questions that you may have for me. If not, you know where to find me.
Representative Krieger.
Representative, are the salmon species Oncorhynchus chowichaw uncovered in this, do you know?
I'm sorry, what?
Oncorhynchus chowichaw.
What did you say, Representative? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I think I'm failing to understand what the good representative is saying to me. I know there's no beer tax in the bill.
Representative Roblin.
The department will clear that up.
I guess what I would like to ask about this question, there have been some very egregious kinds of poachings in time, and I agree with putting certain kinds of animals on it, but to me there should also be a portion that talks about a large kill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I grew up in Port Angeles, Washington, and we have a lot of elk on the Olympic Peninsula, and there was a a group of people, three or four, they think. I don't know if they caught them ever. When I was in high school, who took out a whole herd on the sides of the deal and just killed them all, left them all there, didn't even pick a deal off. They needed to go to jail forever. I mean, everybody in the community was trying to figure out who it was, and I don't know if it was ever found. But and there's other kinds of things that you can do to take out a lot of wildlife in a particular deal. You can mess up a stream. You can do some other kinds of stuff and kill a lot of animals that don't come up to the level. And I think, I don't know, and maybe they are already there. Maybe we have statutes that make those felonies. But to me, those kinds of things that crazy people do from time to time, the penalties need to be really stiff for them, because I've never seen anything worse. I just don't understand how anybody could do it, but it happens.
Yes. Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, they're just lucky I'm not king, because the things I would do to them are illegal, unconstitutional, but they would be very effective. So I guess that's how I'll answer that. But I agree with you, and it's just horrible. The example Mr. Kludig referred to, I can't imagine what was going through those stupid morons' brains when they did that. I just can't imagine that. I know one thing, and Representative, if I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger has served on the Judiciary Committee for years, and as he and the good Chair Barker will tell you, Representative Krieger was chair for, I think, two sessions when I was first here, or the second session, 2005. People that will do this kind of things to animals will do it to people. There's a tendency to do that, an inclination, and these folks are far less than these animals and these resources that we're trying to protect, and I have nothing but unkind words to say about them, so I think I'll just leave it at that.
And they're lucky that real hunters didn't catch them, or the buzzards wouldn't be the ones finding them.
Well, Mr. Chair, I share that sentiment.
Mr. Chair, just a comment, maybe. I was around this for a long time. I want to relate a happening that happened in Curry County after we had established a very good rapport with our courts, where I had found a pickup coming down Rogue River August during archery season. And Sunday, three large elk bulls with the hides on, about 78 degrees. When we stopped them, I checked the tags and opened up the flap where the stomach was. Here's the shattered rib. Obviously, a bullet hole went right through it. Well, I knew what I had then. Two guys and three elk, other guys back in camp. These guys had shot these elk on Friday with the rifle a day before the season. They were absolutely starting to get that kind of a green putrid smell, so it was wanton waste. And, see, that was giving the archer a bad deal, because they're trying to say they kill him with a bow. No, folks. But every game officer has those horror stories somewhere in his career, things where there's really abuse of the resource. In this case, a waste of the resource. Mm-hmm. And those guys went to jail for 75 days, and they had their pickup and guns taken and licenses.
Wow.
And they were Californians. Made it even more fun.
That's right.
Representative Van Orman.
I would just like to let Representative Schaffler know that we are grateful that you are a commoner just like us.
Well, ma'am, Mr. Chair, Madam Representative, yes, I am. I'm just a hard-legged laborer who enjoys public service and has a thimbleful of common sense.
Simple.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Schaffler. I'm going to call up Dennis Ritchie, Bob Salinger, and Tom Wolf.
Chair Clem, representatives, my name is Dennis Ritchie. I'm Executive Director of Oregon Anglers. You have my written comments. I'm not going to totally go over those. However, in the third paragraph, the whole concept of this actually started 3.5 years ago in discussions with state police enforcement, game enforcement officers, and ODFW about the need for clamping down on poachers and also people who bring bait fish into places like Diamond Lake and cause millions of dollars of damage trying to renovate that lake. we did not get our bill through legislative council last session, but this session we started on it early, and ODFW supplied their lawyers to us to get the language, to get a jump on it. At that point, when we got the language back from then, we invited the Oregon Hunters Association and Trout Unlimited into the rewriting group with us, and expanded the bill considerably from just a fisheries bill to a conservation bill, and then later the Audubon Society had an interest in joining us, and we happily invited them to join us also. And it made this bill very complicated, and we've gone back and forth, and there's still a little bit in the language that needs fine-tuning, and the other bill, 3068, is very similar. They changed some of the values and stuff, but the language remains the same. I'd like to answer Representative Roblin's question about the wasting of a number of animals. The actual language in this said taking more than one elk, or the trophy description. And we intend this to be for the really egregious acts committed by poachers, not the average poaching that Representative Krieger mentioned, somebody going out and shooting a deer or an elk to feed their family. That would still be a violation, and we don't intend for that to go away as a misdemeanor. This bill would create a mandatory sentence for those misdemeanors and create two economic penalties, the first being the penalty for breaking the law, going to court and getting sentenced. The second, the civil penalty, gives ODFW the option to go after recouping the cost of the loss of those animals or the damage done. And the third part of the penalty is that they would get a suspension of their privilege to hunt and fish in the state of Oregon. And that already exists, but it expands that to 3 years, 5 years on a second conviction, and a lifetime suspension of those privileges if they were dumb enough to do it, get caught a third time. We feel that if we get the language right, we shouldn't have more than a half a dozen cases a year in the state of Oregon. Some of the ones that would actually feed into this would be the commercial fisherman who had 109 sturgeon in his boat during salmon season. People who get caught netting or gaffing fish out of fish ladders, that sort of thing. And a major wasting of game animals and in some cases raptors. At this point, I would entertain any questions that you have. Or I'll actually probably wait till the others are done. So,
are there any questions? Yes.
Good morning again. My name is Bob Salinger. I'm the Conservation Director for the Portland Audubon Society, and I'm very pleased to be here with hunting and fishing groups today to talk about our mutual shared concerns for the state's fish and wildlife. We support this bill, and we were happy to be included in it. We just saw the new amendments this morning, and we do think there are some tweaks that could make the raptor section a little more effective, and my comments that I passed out are not necessarily germane in terms of the specifics, but we would like to work with you and with other folks on this bill to make some slight changes. The part of the bill that interests our constituents the most is obviously the birds of prey section, and we feel that it's a very important thing that we increase the penalties for wanton and egregious taking of birds of prey. Birds of prey have incredible value to our community. They are incredibly charismatic species that, for a lot of people, are the first introduction to wildlife and to conservation. A lot of people make their first entree into sort of the conservation movement through birds of prey, and they're found on all of our landscapes. They bring a lot of money into our state. Birding brings about $300 million annually into our state. That's from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Report from 2001. they are a huge part of voluntary conservation. We spend a huge number of volunteers get out every year and work on bird of prey surveys to make sure our populations are staying healthy. And we've also spent a tremendous amount bringing back some populations. I think of bald eagles and peregrine falcons, two tremendous success stories that we spent 40 years bringing back. And in an age of voluntary conservation, we're asking a lot of people to step up and do things voluntarily. I think it's very important that we protect the integrity of those contributions and those sacrifices, whether they're birds of prey or deer or elk or fish. Our concern for birds of prey goes back to 1992. I started Audubon in 1992, and I was very, very surprised that one of the first animals I worked on in our rehab center was a peregrine falcon that was shot off a telephone post in northeast Portland. It's a bird that at that time there were only about 15 pairs in the entire state of Oregon. It was an amazing thing to have this in downtown Portland. It was shot off a telephone post. About 1 to 2% of the 3,000 animals we treat a year at Audubon are illegal shootings of birds of prey. That may not sound like a lot, but we just see the tip of the iceberg because we don't get most of them. They don't come in usually. They're not found. They're some of the worst cases we deal with as well. Last year we dealt with two osprey that were shot off their nest and left to die on the ground while their young starved, 3 days apart. And we had hoped that these were isolated cases, albeit way too often, but at least isolated. They weren't organized. But in 2007, we learned there was actually organized killing of bird of prey in the United States and in Oregon. Something we call the roller pigeon cases, a U.S. Fish and Wildlife undercover investigation revealed that roller pigeon clubs that, that raise pigeons with a genetic defect that causes them to tumble when they fly, and there are clubs all across the country, including in Oregon, were targeting birds of prey that either preyed upon their birds when they flew them in the wild or that they thought might prey upon them, particularly redtails, Cooper's hawks, and peregrine falcons. What Fish and Wildlife estimates is that they were killing 2,000 to 3,000 birds of prey a year in the western United States, in Oregon, California, and Washington. I've had the opportunity to talk to a couple of club members that contacted us, and I asked them, were those numbers accurate? And the answer was yes. The numbers are accurate. We were taught three things. We were taught how to raise pigeons. We were taught how to race pigeons and compete them, roll them. And we were taught how to kill birds of prey. These are some of the most nasty cases I've ever seen. They were shooting them. They were trapping them and clubbing them to death. One gentleman was trapping them with pigeons baited with fishing hooks. One gentleman bragged about killing them by spraying a mixture of bleach and ammonia into their eyes and mouths and watching them suffocate. One gentleman bragged about baiting them into glass panels so he could watch them crash through the glass. He'd put a bait behind the glass panels. Very, very nasty cases. We believe that these kinds of things require much more severe penalties. We appreciate this bill. We appreciate your support for it. I do want to read you one quote that gives you an idea of the mentality here. This was very personal for us because we've worked on peregrine falcons. We have hundreds of thousands of dollars invested in peregrine falcon recovery at Audubon. One of the things we do is raise and release peregrines to the wild. Apparently, they shot our peregrines. They bragged on their website openly about it. The quote was, "I laughed and I laughed when I heard this story because of all the hard, painstaking measures to get these birds to adolescence and then to have someone take them out was pure bliss. Use the 3S system. Shoot, shovel, and shut up." So we want to make a strong statement. We want to see the penalties increased. We're not trying to go after the minor stuff. We're trying to go after the bad stuff, send a very strong message, and make sure people understand that if they kill birds of prey, they're going to suffer a penalty, and make sure the public understands that when they invest in voluntary conservation and helping bring these species back, that effort isn't going to be wasted. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for coming, sir. And I appreciate your support of this bill. And I don't support every single radical environmental idea that comes down the hill. I think that's no secret in this building. That being said, I just wanted to share something with you because it's important to me that you and others know this. You're exactly right about our introduction to wildlife. Birds, clearly children are fascinated by flight, as they should be. Our daughter came home from school and they were learning about birds and things of that, and she wanted to do a project, and I learned through her that the disappearance of songbirds as a result of us human beings spreading out, that there were things we could do by providing habitat for them. And what we did was build some birdhouses and hung them in our backyard. And that was when Marcella was in, God, I don't know what grade.
Third.
Is elementary school.
And we those birdhouses are every year being used in our yard. And it was a really great lesson for her and for me, I might add. But I really do appreciate the work the Audubon Society's done. We've been out to your office out there up on the hill in Northwest Portland, and just it, you know, it, you're exactly right. Children are introduced to wildlife frequently through birds and flight, just by seeing them in all their glory in this world. So I really appreciate you supporting this bill, and it's good to work with you all and folks like you, if I may, on a bill that we can all agree on. So keep up the good work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are we still having the problem in feathers? A lot of these birds, especially the eagles and others, people want the feathers for certain things. Do we still have that group out there hunting them?
We
and I have
still
a second
do.
Question as well.
We still do. We have problems with people just killing them gratuitously because they're slow-moving, easy targets. We have problems because people misperceive what birds of prey do, sort of this old bias is built in, and they have value, too. So we have people taking them specifically for their talons, for their feathers, all the different things that really have been writ large for a century.
And
follow-up?
Since I have somebody from the Audubon Society, I just had to ask this question. There's a really great bill that has to do with taxing bird seed. And it taxes bird seed so that the tax would go to providing the same kinds of things that our hunting fees and all the things we're going to have to pass through do. I would love the Audubon Society to think about ways in which our resources can continue to be captured. You put money into it on your own. I recognize that. So do the hunters and fishermen and all their organizations. But when it comes to keeping our agents in the field and other kinds of stuff, it tends to be the fees that are paid by hunters and fishermen as opposed to some of the others. And I look at this as an opportunity to start coming together like we have in this bill over finding resources to keep our wildlife protected and working with them. So Thank you.
I greatly appreciate the question, because this bill is actually incredibly near and dear to my heart, and it's near and dear to Audubon's heart. We've been advocating for something like this since I started there in 1992. I love this bill. And our board loves this bill, and our staff loves this bill. And we were one of the folks that originated it. And I would love to support it in this session. I'm going to tell you the reason I'm not supporting it very briefly. I know this is what we're on today. And that is because we have heard from small bird seed stores, and I believe them on this because our bird seed store told us the same thing, even though we overruled them and said we're still going to support it, that with the economy, they are not, they fear they're going to have to lay people off, and there will be a hit. And so out of respect to them, we backed off of it, and we want to bring it back in 2011. And I've testified before. In fact, I've come down when we raised fishing fees and testified at those hearings. Thank you to the fishermen for agreeing to raise your fees. You should point the lens at us now, and you should tax us. Recreational users, birders, should absolutely be paying their fair share. It's an equity issue. So does that make sense in terms of why we're not?
It does. Okay. I've actually got the letter because I'm on the bill. But I actually got the letter, and I understand that. But it's still frustrating to me.
It is absolutely frustrating.
Did you have a question, Representative Gilliam?
No, what is he doing?
Okay. Moving on to serious things, Tom.
That was serious.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. We have been a big supporter of this bill since Dennis talked to me about it almost 2 years ago, and I've been very thankful for his concern to get some of the language that I wanted into this bill, and primarily, first of all, we're supportive of all parts of this bill about dealing with poaching and illegal taking of raptors. But the part that we're really interested in, and this is covered in the Dash 1 amendment, is the part that deals with releasing fish that are not native to Oregon that could harm flora and fauna. One of the prime examples of this has already been mentioned by Dennis, but I'll elaborate a little bit, is the Diamond Lake case where some fishermen, even though it's a state statute and has been for a long time, you're not allowed to use live bait, live fish bait in fishing. It's supposed to be dead when you put it. They dumped some tui chubs into Diamond Lake that propagated and greatly expanded, and the state had to spend millions of dollars to drain the lake and to roten on the lake and then restock it. It caused a major hit to the monies of the state in a time when we didn't need major hits. And there are other cases like this where people intentionally put in non-native species that are have a deliberate and nasty effect on native species, and this bill has language in it that deals very effectively with that. So we support greatly this bill. We are thankful to be able to work with groups like Oregon Anglers, Oregon Hunters Association, and Audubon on this bill, and we think it's a great bill in all parts, and we urge you to pass it through. Thank you.
Thank you. We only have a few minutes left, and we have two more people to testify. So David Moskowitz and Ron Hardy.
We got so many dashes coming, so many bills, and so many committees. I can't keep track.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder, the Oregon consultant for the National Rifle Association. Representative Krieger had asked me to work with Mr. Elkins and some other members to amend the basic bill. I've talked to Denny Ritchie, and unfortunately, the amendments just came out this morning, actually, after this meeting started, and there are some errors in them. But basically what we did is take Mr. Elkins' bill that had the specifics as to the size of animals and those kind of things and include them in 3089. We also made some adjustments, and they have not been discussed yet, took out the felony provisions from the bill, and that was with the bill sponsor's direction. That was for a number of reasons. Felonies, of course, as everyone knows, they go from fiscal, where you would have to have a grand jury and a jury trial and whatever, and be very expensive. Plus, the penalties for those were pretty extreme, even for these very, very bad cases of poaching. Unfortunately, the amendments, which are the dash twos, came back from Legislative Council. They left out the raptors that we had asked to have included, and also left out salmon steelhead and sturgeon, and so that has to be corrected. There was in the dash twos a difference from what we asked for as far as the penalty went, and there are a number of other things, but I think in the view of time, we're going to have to go back to a working group on this anyhow, and then everyone will have the amendments in front of them when we get finished with these, and I think it would be a smoother flow if we waited until then.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. David.
Thank you. Vice Chair Van Orman and members of the committee, David Moskowitz here today on behalf of the Native Fish Society, and we'd like to just say that we support this bill. We have appreciated working with the drafters, particularly Dennis Ritchie and Fred Van Natt, who's not here. There's a lot of passion among the people who have been before you today about this because people care deeply about these species, whether you're watching them, catching them, or shooting them. And I think that's clear. We appreciate being included in the work group and trying to work to craft a bill that will address the egregious illegal takings. And I think I'll leave it at that as time is short. Happy to answer any questions, and we look forward to working with the drafters of the bill. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. And I will close the public hearing on 3089. And we will carry over the work sessions on House Bills 2636 and 3089 for a regular meeting on Thursday, April 23rd at 8 o'clock. And then we will carry over public hearing and possible work session on 3078 for this evening's meeting in Hearing Room F at 5:30 this afternoon. And then on HB 2742, from Tuesday, we have more written testimony to acknowledge. From Mike Dykesel. Okay. Having said that, I will adjourn the meeting of the House Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities.